Good evening and welcome. Once again, wonderful to have the opportunity to do some learning with you. When we last left our friends in Frankfurt, the year was 1717. The last personality that we discussed was a man called Rabbi Avraham Broda, who served as chief rabbi of Frankfurt for only a short period of time. He came in 1712. Following the great fire that led to the end of the career of Rav Naftali Katz in 1711. Rav Avraham Broda got to Frankfurt in 1712, and he died in 1717. So the community of Frankfurt obviously needed to hire a new rabbi, and they hired a man called Rabbi Yaakov Poppers. Rabbi Yaakov Poppers, who served as the rabbi of Frankfurt from 1718 to 1740 until his death. So who was this man? And again, you're talking about one of the most prominent, one of the most prestigious pulpits in all of Europe. It's occupied by this man, Rav Yaakov Poppers. Who was he? So Rav Yaakov Poppers was born in Prague in 1617. And he served in Koblenz from around 1697 until 1718. He was there for about 20 years. Koblenz is a small town situated on the banks of the Rhine River. The role meant that he would be ministering not just to the Jews of Koblenz, but sometimes rabbis were hired to serve a larger community. So you're serving the local city of Koblenz and then the environs, and there's smaller pockets of little tiny Jewish communities that obviously can't support their own rabbis. So it's a kind of central model where the rabbi of the bigger town also ministers to the rabbis of the surrounding towns. He was also the rabbi of Trier, which was 100 kilometers away. So it's a big area. Even though, you know, there may not have been, you know, tens of thousands of Jews in the population. Koblenz was a community that was wealthy enough and self-sufficient enough to build themselves a new shul in 1702. We have records of the shul that they built in 1702. But Rav Poppers was well-liked and well-respected, and he had earned a deserved reputation as being a leading rabbi. And he had bigger ambitions. So in 1710, he applied to be the rabbi of the Ashkenazic Jewish community of Amsterdam, which again, like, is a top prize for an aspiring young rabbi in the beginning of the 18th century. And it's actually an amazing election for that rabbinic post. We have the records of the election. There were four candidates. One of the candidates was Rav Yaakov Poppers, okay, who again we know went on to become chief rabbi of Frankfurt. A second candidate was Rav Yaakov Yoshua Falk, who we'll talk about next week, who was arguably, he was a young man at the time, but by the time we're going to meet him next week, he's one of the, if not the most prominent rabbinic authority of the entire 18th century, staggering. The last candidate was Chacham Tzvi, who at this point was already relatively a senior. It's like all the top rabbis in the world are applying for this position. Chacham Tzvi wins in a landslide for reasons that we could talk about at another time. Rav Yaakov Poppers continues in Koblenz until 1718, when he is offered the position, when he's offered the position to be the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, which he accepts. Becomes the chief rabbi, he's the Rosh Hashiva, he's the Av Beis Din, and he continues. Remember, we talked about the students of Rav Avraham Broda and these students who would flock from far and near to study with Rav Avraham Broda and the prestigious Frankfurt yeshiva, or there may have been actually more than one yeshiva at the time. Rav Yaakov Poppers continues this tradition, and students continue to flock from near and wide to study in Frankfurt. I want to get to 1735, which is going to be the key date for our discussion tonight. It should tell you something, just based on what we know about some of the previous personalities that we've talked about. Just the fact that Rav Yaakov Popper's endured as the rabbi of this community for 22 years should tell you something about his capacity as a communal rabbi. It was no small feat to make it to the end of your contract, which was typically 3 years. To make it 22 years was a big deal. Okay, so he's good at what he does on a lot of levels. Again, we're heading to 1735, which is going to be the key date for us. But before we get there, I just want to pause to say something about what happened in 1725. And this is actually going to be important for us for next week's class as well, sowing the seeds of controversy that we'll discuss more in depth next week. So in 1725, there was a man called Moses Meir Kaminker, and he was a scholar of some repute, and he was also quite adept at dissimulation. He was a secret Sabbatian, and again, as we've talked about a little in each of the previous sessions, Sabbatianism is, it's looming, it's in the background, it's not in the foreground. Shabtai Tzvi had already died by 1676, and already by the time he apostatized in 1667, most of his followers had reverted to traditional Judaism. But there were, and we don't have the numbers, but there were these crypto-Sabbateans, these underground Sabbateans who continued to believe in the messiahship of Shabtai Tzvi, which again is almost definitionally heretical. So they don't want to advertise themselves because they'll be cast out of the community, and they may just blend in because they're not necessarily public antinomians. They go to shul and they keep Shabbos. You wouldn't know it, but secretly in their little networks, they are followers of Shabtai Tzvi. So Moses Meir Kaminker is one of these crypto Sabbateans, and he's traveling through Europe as an emissary to Moravia and Bohemia and Germany to make connections in this network. And he visits Prague, where he had some kind of relationship with Jonas and Eibeschitz that we'll come back to next week. Number of other communities to secretly spread Sabbateanism. Somehow, maybe accidentally, someone betrayed him, and when he got to Frankfurt, it became known that he was carrying a cachet of Sabbatean manuscripts. Okay, and the cat was out of the bag, and he was exposed. And we have this amazing document, which you can see on your source sheet. As I mentioned in our first class, I wanted to give you a sense of some of the different kinds of documents that we find from this period. So this is a broadside. So what's a broadside? A broadside is a public notice that would be hung in a shul, in a beis medrash, in a public place, where people would come to read public declarations and public announcements. Okay. So this one is a public proclamation put out by, by three communities. Okay. So there's an announcement from the community of Frankfurt, an announcement from the community of Prague, and an announcement from the community of Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, the triple community, you know, basically around the city of Hamburg. What's the announcement? The announcement is, we want everyone to know that we've identified a secret member of this a Sabbatean sect, and everyone needs to know that he's banned, he's put in a cherem, his writings are banned. If anybody starts associating with him, they'll be banned. I'll just show you a quick excerpt. It's like half Yiddish, half Hebrew. You have to sort your way through it. Herzu Rabosai Miachar Sha'avar Aleinu Po Ishrau V'Lial HaNikra Moshe Ben Meir Mizelkova. attention, everyone should hear this. We've identified this terrible criminal, a man called Moshe Ben Meir, who's originally from the town of Zelkov, a Polish Jew. What did he do? Velcher mesaviv meir leir leir is lahasis ladiach spnei amenu lahamin b'shabtai tzvi yamach shemo. He's going around from town to town, from city to city, trying to recruit Sabadians to his cause, which is terrible. She amuna kozeves ben ifsedes voy ich verklich ksavim ksavim shonim mishunim etzlo gefunden werden seinen gestan charuf geduf she'en lahalos al niyar. And we found these writings that we can't even commit them to paper. What the kinds of things that we found on this guy are so terrible and so damning, we're not even going to say what they were. However, we will say, Mitochan Masav Nikar Shehu, Shliach U'Mesaras La'Avera Min Kesher Shel Rishayim V'lo Midai Tu Me'atzmo Levad Yatza Ki'im Min HaKlal Kulo Yatza. We've identified him as a Sabadian. It's clear as day, and it's not just him, it's everything that's attached to him, it's this whole cachet. The broadside goes on to say, anybody has any association with them, he's out, they're out, it's all terrible, and we have to act, and we have to respond. So as the chief rabbi of Frankfurt, it's Rav Yaakov Poppers who's responsible for bringing this to light, exposing this Sabadian, and then functionally removing him from the community, and then communicating all of this between and among various other communities. You know, sadly, we have similar issues today. It's like somebody's doing something terrible, and he says a cherem against this guy. Okay, so he just picks up and goes to the next community. So you have to alert the next community that, right, something is amiss here. Obviously, in a pre-modern context, it's not easy to do, and people can slip through the cracks. But you do the best you can, and you put out these broadsides as widely as possible, and disseminate them to make it clear to everyone just what kind of problem might be at hand. Okay. So Rav Yaakov Poppers is here in Frankfurt, 1718. He takes the position, 1725. There's this public controversy around secret Sabadian that he exposes and manages to banish from Frankfurt. All the while, he's building up his yeshiva. He has a whole list of dozens and dozens of students who become and go on to become very prominent leaders in the Jewish community. Rav Elchanan Ashkenazi, who becomes the author of the Sidrei Tara, and Rav David Tevelis Shoyer, who ends up being the teacher of the Chasam Sofer of Mordechai Halberstadt, who is the author of the Mamar Mordechai, on and on down the list. All these people coming through Frankfurt and being exposed to the teaching of Rav Yaakov Poppers. We may not know his name, but a little like Rav Avraham Broda, he's responsible for training a whole generation of future leaders. Okay, so let me just share with you, just so you have a flavor for who he is. Just one tshuva that he wrote. Rav Yaakov Poppers wrote one book. Wasn't published in his lifetime. His sons published it shortly after he died in 1742. But they wrote in the introduction to this book, you know, of all the things that he wrote, the most important to him was his collection of Shilas and Shuvos. And they produced this really beautiful book called The Shav Yaakov. And again, I'll just say in passing, you know, we talked about Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kaidanover's Kav HaYashar in our first session. I said, you know, it was republished like dozens and dozens of times in various languages, and is so popular. Okay, so just by way of comparison, Shav Yaakov, which is written by the chief rabbi of Frankfurt. Okay, you have to imagine that, you know, he has hundreds and hundreds of students. Everybody knows him. Everybody knows his name. And widely acclaimed, and his book gets republished from 1742 to 2023. And how many times the book has been republished? Zero. There is one edition of this book. It has never been republished. The Bar Ilan CD-ROM, which has hundreds and hundreds of Shilas, it's not even been digitalized, right? There's only one edition of this book. Stunningly, it gets quoted often by other poskim and other gedolim, but stunningly, never republished. And again, I just say it by way of comparison to understand what it means for someone else's book to be published, 80 times or 100 times. Purim's coming, so I picked a Purim Shaila. Okay, someone wrote to Rav Yaakov Poppers and said, "I have the following question. You ready for this?" He says, "I can pick up here. This is source number one on your source sheet." Somebody writes to Rav Yaakov Poppers, another important rabbi, and he says the following. I got the following question, and this would happen in the course of Shiles and Tshuvas. You're a junior rabbi, or maybe the rabbi of a small town, and sometimes you get questions that are above your pay grade, and you want to consult with someone who knows more and is more senior and is older. So you write a letter to someone who you may know or who you may know of, and you say, "I got the following question. This is my thinking. Does that make sense to you? Could you guide me? Do you think that's right? Do you have a different opinion?" So this more junior rabbi writes to Rav Yaakov Poppers in Frankfurt and says, here's the issue. I got a question for someone in my community. They were reading their Megillah. Okay, they had a Megillas Esther. And in the Megillah, here it is, in line three of this second paragraph. Be'echad she'egia Megillah achas u'matza kasuba tevas la'yehudim betosfos hei Ben Vav Lidalis. Okay, so you see this word La'yehudim. La'yehudim, that word appears a number of times in the Megillah. So he says, one of the times that the word appears in the Megillah, there's an extra letter. Okay, and after the Vav, between the Dalid, is an extra Hey. And it says La'yehu Hadim, something like that. So sometimes there's a missing letter, sometimes there's an extra letter, and you could correct it. So you add the letter that's missing, you erase the letter that's extra. He says, the problem is, in this bizarro case, it just so happens, Nimtza, do you see what the issue is? Nimtza, yesh ba osio shem havaya, sirufin, zel zeh. You see where the extra letter got added? It now says, lamed yud hey, vav hey. In there is a yud ke vav ke, it's Hashem's name. You're not allowed to erase Hashem's name. So what do you do with this extra letter? On the one hand, you want to make the Megillah kosher by taking out the hey. You take out the hey, you're erasing Hashem's name. Now let's erase Hashem's name. Oh, well, that's tricky. What do you do? What do you say? So this junior rabbi writes to Rav Yaakov Poppers and says, can you erase the hey? And Rav Yaakov Poppers is also interesting just to see how he responds. And I'll just sort of summarize it for you. He says, look, I'm very busy. And with my students day and night, he says, "Hine afshani taridna meod al haTorah ve'al haAvoda avodas tamidis im talmidim b'shiurim deoraisa." He says, "I'm a busy guy. I'm the chief rabbi of Frankfurt." Don't mean to put words in his mouth, but he's saying, "I got a lot going on here." So he makes a little excuse. He says, "I'm not able to give you an encyclopedic, answer to this question. So I'm just going to kind of answer quickly," even though he writes a, pretty lengthy answer for a busy guy. He says, "Nonetheless, I'll just let you know my first impression. My first impression is that it's not a problem. Nobody wrote this with kavana, so it doesn't take on the same level of prohibition that it would if somebody wrote, they're writing Sefer Torah and they write the shame of Hashem, so you're not allowed to write. It's not this case. It was just an error. It was just a mistake, and you could correct it. It's not an issue." Okay. So in the interest of time, just leave that as an example of the authorship and the halachic contributions of Rav Yaakov Poppers. So I want to fast forward now to 1735, but before we do, I need to take you on a detour. So we're leaving Frankfurt. Yaakov Poppers is the chief rabbi, and things are going relatively nicely. As we talked about last time, the Jewish city in the aftermath, the Jewish community in the aftermath of the fire, rebuilt the Judengasse. They have a very functional Beis Din that people use all the time, and a very functional and popular yeshiva that students are flocking to, and economically things are okay. And Rav Yaakov Poppers, all the while, chief rabbi of Frankfurt am Main. Leave Frankfurt and let's head south for a few minutes to Padua. Padua is, I'm sorry, I don't have a map on the source sheet, but it's right near Venice, right? It's 40 kilometers from Venice at, let's say, the top, right, toward the northern border of present day Italy. Okay. So in 1707 in Padua, the Ramchal is born, a man called Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was born into a very well-to-do and prestigious family. The Luzzatto family was very well known. His father was a wealthy merchant, and young Moshe Chaim received a top-notch education, and not just a Torah education, but a very wide-reaching general education. So, and again, we're not in Eastern Europe anymore. We're in Italy. It's a different time. It's a different place. So he's educated by his father in Latin and in other languages, and at the same time he's receiving thorough rabbinic education. He's a child prodigy, recognized as a genius, as a wunderkind. Already at a very young age, he's writing plays and poetry and all kinds of literature, much of which we have today. Okay. At a very young age, let's say maybe his late teens, early 20s, he starts a study group in his home. Now, just a word about Padua. Padua is an important community for a number of reasons, one of which is that there's a medical school in Padua, and it is one of, if not the only medical school in the world at the time that grants degrees to Jews. So you have Jewish medical students in Padua, and the Ramchal creates a secret circle called the Chevra Mevakshei Hashem, a secret circle of Illuminati who gathered around a central figure with the goal of redeeming the world and restoring primordial harmony. Number of his students were these medical students at the University of Padua. And he's very busy producing not just the poetry and plays of his youth, but now he's writing psalms, he's writing Tehillim, he's writing mystical works, he's writing a kind of new Zohar, and he reports in his diary that he is visited by a magid. Okay, I have this for you in source number 3, an English translation of how he describes what happens when he was visited by a magid. What's a magid? A magid is a heavenly voice, some kind of angelic voice, heavenly voice, something like this. And this is his report. Okay, he writes the following. He says it occurred. It occurred on May 24th, 1727. He's 20. As I was immersed in one yichud, I fell into a slumber, and upon waking, I heard a voice saying, I am descending, quote, I am descending to reveal the hidden secrets of the Holy King. For a short while, I stood trembling. Then I revived myself. The voice did not cease, but revealed a secret to me. The next day, at the same time, I tried to be alone in the room, and the voice returned with another secret until it revealed to me that it was a magid sent from heaven. He taught me private yichudim upon which to meditate in order to procure his presence so I could summon him. I couldn't see him. Only his voice spoke through my mouth, and later he gave me permission to ask things of him. After 3 months, he gave me private tikkunim, restorative prayers to recite each day in order to merit the revelation of Elijah. You want to see Eliyahu HaNavi? Ramchal knows how to commune with Eliyahu HaNavi. Then Elijah appeared and announced that Metatron, the Grand Minister of Heaven, would appear. From that time, I recognized each one, although sometimes souls reveal themselves to me whose names I did not know. So the Ramchal reports to his students and to his circle that he's receiving revelations from a magid. He's receiving revelations from a magid. Around 2 years later, one of his students, a man called Yekutiel Gordon, writes a letter to a friend or family member in Vienna, and says something to the effect of, you know, this great rabbi with whom I'm studying, the Ramchal, is the new Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. He's like the reincarnation of Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, who was reputed to be the author of the Zohar. And somehow this letter gets out. The letter gets out, and people start to wonder what's happening here. This is a very young man who's reporting that he's having visions and revelations, and people are starting to get a little nervous. What's happening here? There's a man called Rav Moshe Chagiz. There's a man called Rav Moshe Chagiz, who, if I remember correctly, was living in Altona, Hamburg-Wandsbek at the time. And Rav Moshe Chagiz was a kind of professional heresy hunter. He was very keen on ferreting out Sabbateans and crypto-Sabbateans and secret-Sabbateans. And if there was any kind of heresy going on behind the scenes, he wanted to know about it. He wanted to make it public, and he wanted to rid the community of it. So he was involved, for instance, last week I had mentioned that Rav Naftali Katz had mistakenly or erroneously given an approbation to a book by a man called Nechemia Chayon when he had met him in Prague, and then the book got published, and it was a book full of Sabbatian heresy. So Rav Moshe Chagiz was instrumental in outing the author of that heretical work. So when he gets word that there's a man called Moshe Chaim Lutzato who is claiming that he's receiving revelations from a magid, when Moshe Chagiz gets word of this, he starts to begin a anti-heresy crusade, because that's what he always does. And he starts alerting the rabbis of various communities and letting them know that there's a potential problem here. There might be some kind of real new cult, new band of heretical Jews. We don't even know, but there is a problem. So among the issues that get raised over the course of a controversy that we'll talk about in a second, everyone gets pretty upset at the Ramchal. First of all, the notion that revelation was continuing through a magid was in and of itself threatening and problematic, particularly in the case of someone who's not just not 40, but only 20. And particularly because this is happening outside of Eretz Yisrael, people are not denying the fact that there could be revelation by a magid. They're just concerned that this is happening in Padua to a man, you know, claiming to have some kinds of special powers that we've not really heard of. That's the problem. In addition, there's a man called Rav Binyamin Cohen, who's a known Sabbatian, who got all excited about Ramchal and said, oh, this is the cat's meow, and we're all... Right. So that wasn't helping Ramchal's cause to have a secret Sabbatian championing him and rooting for him. Okay. In addition, there was this, you know, kind of general discomfort with the sense that a Kabbalist would be disseminating Kabbalah to the masses. Kabbalah is meant to be disseminated from a teacher to a student, and if you're not among the initiates, well, you shouldn't be studying Kabbalah. So what is Ramchal doing writing these Kabbalistic treatises and making them available to the masses? Okay. So we'll see in a second. There were other issues as well, but the trouble started brewing when Moshe Chagiz started to sound the alarm bell and wrote a letter to the rabbis of Venice. And again, just sort of like the Koblenz, Trier. So Venice is the big city and Padua is the smaller city, and the Venetian rabbinate holds sway in the area. But Moshe Chagiz lets the Venetian rabbis know that there might be a problem in the neighboring town. Okay, I'll just give you a kind of snippet from Shmuel Feiner's book, The Jewish 18th Century, who kind of puts this in a succinct way, summarizing what's happening. He says, a huge and unbridgeable gap yawned between Ramchal's self-image as a man who had been privileged with revelation and was capable of reaching religious heights and revealing secrets, and that of those looking from the outside at an enthusiastic and irresponsible young man who did not understand the consequences of his pretension, whose charisma overwhelmed his good sense, and who had to be put in his place, whether by persuasion or threats. So Ramchal doesn't think he's doing anything wrong. He thinks he's just revealing what is meant to be revealed and taking a leadership position because he's meant to be a leader. And the rest of the world is looking in on this, and they get very suspicious. So the Venetian rabbis prevail upon Rabbi Yeshaya Bassan, who was the teacher of Ramchal in Padua, to put a lid on things. Okay. And they insist that Ramchal cease and desist. Okay. And they say he has to stop this public preaching of Kabbalah, and he has to stop disseminating Kabbalistic treatises. And if he doesn't, there's going to be a problem. Okay. So I have for you in source number 5, the rabbis of Venice functionally make Ramchal swear an oath. In source number 5, we can pick up from the middle paragraph here, beginning with the word liyot. Okay, liyot na'asef elai v'gonez kashir ratze kavod terasa kol chibori asher asisi ad hayam hazeh al pi amagid v'nishamos kedoshim shelo yetzu chutza ela al piv kol yemei chayav. So first he says, you know what they made me do is they made me swear an oath that from this day forward I would put in Geniza, I would bury anything that I had written that had anything to do with Kabbalistic revelations or anything that I had heard from the Magid. Next paragraph, Agam Yachshav, Ayem Ashiv Yad Yadi Milchtov Od Shum Chibur Belashan Zohar, O Be'ezelashan Shiye, B'Shem Magid, O Nishamas Kedoshim, and not just anything that I wrote in the past, but I promise not ever again from this day forward to write anything further that is related to the Zohar or related to Kabbalistic treatises or related to revelations from a Magid. Kol hadvarim, last paragraph, ha'ele kibalti al atzmi b'chol tokef l'bitzel kol madai o'madai ularayos ha'emes chasamti shmi. And he said, you know, I accepted this. It's an allusion to the fact that, you know, he took an oath on a Sefer Torah. And he signs it with, this is me, Po, Padua, Yom Beis, Shlosha Lechodesh Menachem Av, Shnas HaTafzadi Lebriyas HaOlam, VaKol Sharir VaKayam. It's his official signature, signed, sealed, and delivered. It's Monday, and it is the third day of Av. It's the year 1730, and he takes this oath. He's going to cease and desist. And if anybody had any suspicions that maybe he's a Sabbatian or he's a heretic, he's doing something that's not appropriate, it's okay. I accept. I will put a stop to everything. Okay. So things get a little quieter. And from 1730 to about 1734, Ramchal goes about his business in Padua, And he's busy teaching and learning and writing, and we don't really hear any further controversy. But around 1734, 1735, another controversy erupts, and there's another ban pronounced by the rabbis of Venice. They claim that that Ramchal has violated his own oath, and he is teaching Kabbalah and he is writing about it. And at this point, Ramchal says, "I'm not doing this anymore. I'm out." Okay, and he decides it's time to leave Padua. He's heading for Amsterdam. Now, why is he heading for Amsterdam? He's heading to Amsterdam for a few reasons. He's heading to Amsterdam because Amsterdam is the center of print. It is the publishing capital of the world. You could print a book in Italy, but if you want to print a beautiful book and you want to print a book that's going to get its widest possible audience, you go to Amsterdam. So he definitely has his eye on printing something, probably something to do with Kabbalah that he surely couldn't print in Venice. And he wants to go to Amsterdam to print his book. He has a brother who lives there. And if he can't make a living because people are pouncing on him in Padua, so he'll probably be able to make a living in Amsterdam. And he's heading to Amsterdam because Amsterdam by the 1730s has a deserved reputation for being an exceptionally tolerant place to be. And even someone who's a little heretical or suspected of being a little heretical could probably do just fine in Amsterdam. You know, in 2023, we would say it's, you know, a more tolerant, more liberal environment as opposed to, you know, a more religiously conservative environment. So 1734, the winter of 1735, Ramchal quits Italy and heads for Amsterdam. He makes it as far as Frankfurt, and that is where our story picks up. Rav Yaakov Poppers is waiting for Ramchal because he's heard all about him. He's received letters from the likes of Rav Moshe Chagiz, and he's been tracking the goings on over the past years. And remember, we had already seen that in 1725, Rav Yaakov Poppers jumped on a secret Sabbatian who had come to Frankfurt and banned him. And when Ramchal comes to Frankfurt, the chief rabbi, Rav Yaakov Poppers, invites him to a meeting. Ramchal writes in his own diary that it was an ambush. He thought this Rav Yaakov Poppers would welcome him. It would be one Talmid Chacham talking to another, but that was not the case at all. Okay. I'll just share with you a letter from later in this campaign to put things in context before we talk about the trial of Ramchal in front of Rav Yaakov Poppers. Rav Yaakov Poppers said, "You know, I heard a lot about what's happening in Padua, and there's this man, the Ramchal, and he's teaching the Kabbalah, which is very upsetting. And there was this other kind of a rumor or a suspicion that that the Ramchal had written a new Tehillim." What does that even mean to write a new Tehillim? So Rav Yaakov Popper says, "I heard the Afgam Shara Ra'inu She'emesu. I discovered it was true. Shechiber Kuf Nun Mizmure Tehillim B'makom Tehillim L'David." He says Ramchal was so audacious that he wrote a new Tehillim to replace the book of Tehillim written by David HaMelech as part of the canon of Tanakh. I mean, it's a crazy thing. What does that mean? He says, "Upashat yado b'David Mashiach Elokei Yaakov v'omer shehen b'teilim lasi lavo." Like, what is Ramchal thinking that he's going to replace David HaMelech's Tehillim? Halo reino kadosh baruch hu kara Mashiach sh'asid al shem David. We know that, right? David is the father, the grandfather of the Davidic line, of the line of Mashiach. We know this already. How could you replace Tehillim written by David? It can't be. So it's a mystery. Like, did he really do it? Did he really write Tehillim to replace David HaMelech's Tehillim? So it turns out that he did. And we have that. And I have for you reproduced in sources number 7 and 8, two chapters of Tehillim that the Ramchal wrote. For what purpose, we're not in a position to say. But it's kind of wild that the Ramchal had actually done what Rav Yaakov Poppers had suspected him of doing, namely, had written a new series of Tehillim. Okay, and on your own, you could peruse them in sources number 7 and 8 in your search. Okay. So now back to 1735. There's an ambush. Ramchal arrives in Frankfurt. Rav Yaakov Popper says, "Welcome. I'd like you to join me and to stand in front of my base, because this is my town and you're passing through. But now that you're here, you have some hard questions to answer." So Rav Yaakov Poppers, again, we have all of this correspondence, writes a letter to Moshe Chagiz. Moshe Chagiz says, you have to expect that this man's going to come through your town and you have to be ready. And Rav Yaakov Poppers writes back and said, "I was ready, all right. And I'm going to tell you what I did." He says, I convened a Beis Din. And I said, you have to relinquish all of your writings and all of your papers, and you have to take a new shvua, you have to take a new oath, and you have to promise while holding a sefer Torah that you are not going to write any more Kabbalistic treatises, and that you're not going to print anything in public, and otherwise we're gonna ban you faster than you can say boo. And he takes this, Ramchal is forced to take this oath. He writes, a little time, a little later, once he gets to Amsterdam, reflecting on what happened, he says to his Rebbe, to Rabbi Yeshaya Bassan, that guy Poppers made me take that oath. Let me just tell you how valid that oath was. He basically put a gun to my head. It was under duress. And, I didn't mean anything I said, so you can't hold me to anything I said in that oath. But the story happened. He stood in front of the Beis Din of Rav Yaakov Poppers and took a shvua that said, "I am not going to write or teach anything Kabbalistic from this day forward. Okay. Now, what had happened to all of the writings and treatises that that the Ramchal had written in Padua? So virtually all of them had been confiscated by the Venetian rabbinic authorities, and they'd been consigned to a trunk, sealed and locked. Why this happened is not entirely clear to me, but as part of his anti-Ramchal crusade, Rav Yaakov Poppers wrote to the folks in Venice and said, "Give me the trunk. Send me the ark, the trunk of letters written by not just letters, but any of the writings of Ramchal that you confiscated from him. And I'm going to see for myself what they're all about." We have the records of the shipping, receipts. The trunk makes it all the way from Venice to Frankfurt. Rav Yaakov Poppers is now in receipt of this trunk. He looks at some of the documents, and he says, "This is a problem. This is a real problem." He goes back and forth with his students, with his Beis Din. What are we going to do with these documents? And they decide some of them need to be burned, and the rest can be buried. Okay. And we have a record of this story. Rav Yaakov Poppers tells us just what it is he did with these documents. And he says, A few of them needed to be burned. The rest of them needed to be consigned to burial. Buried in a secret location. The only two people who know the location of this ark containing the documents of the Ramchal are these two messengers that the Beis Din assigned to bury the ark under the streets of the Frankfurt Judengasse. Ve'af gam sham genizasan ve'ofem shibizman karov yarkivu v'yeschiku osam karka olam. They were buried in such a way that they would disintegrate and be lost speedily in our days. Okay. So I titled this class when Rav Moshe Chaim Litzado stood trial in Frankfurt and an all too true tale of a lost ark. It's a real thing. No one has ever found it. Probably no one has ever looked. At some point, there was a box buried under the Judengasse in Frankfurt containing the confiscated Kabbalistic writings of Ramchal. What a crazy story. Ramchal continues on his journey. He had just about enough of his friends in Frankfurt, and he makes it to Amsterdam. He basically has 10 years of peace and quiet in Amsterdam, and he continues to write and produce and publish. Okay, and we have and know many of his works, Das Tunos and Mesilas Yesharim. And these works that become world famous in the course of time. He doesn't have a position of authority. He's just kind of in a kind of kollel in the Amsterdam Sephardic community, but he's warmly embraced and becomes very comfortable living in Amsterdam for the next 10 years. He emigrates to the Holy Land, and very soon after tragically dies in a plague along with his family at the age of 40. Now, in the time that we have remaining, I want to explore with you a difficult question. Now, based on the information that I just shared with you, while it's true that we didn't focus on Ramchal, had a couple of defenders, but what I didn't share with you is the ban that Rav Yaakov Popper's disseminated against Ramchal took hold in all the major cities of Europe. So in a dozen European Jewish communities, there were these broadsides, and I could show them to you. We have them. Hanging on every shul that said, there's a man called Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. He's from Padua. Maybe you heard of him. He's written a lot of things, and there's a lot of suspicion that he's a heretic. Don't read anything he's written. If you have any of his books, get rid of them right away. It's a cherem, it's a cherem, it's a cherem. So that's what's circulating in 1735 in Venice and Frankfurt and Berlin and Prague and on and Hamburg and all over the Jewish community, all over the Jewish map of Europe and the Ottoman Empire. And yet, in 2023, I would challenge you to find a Beis Medrash in which the books of Ramchal are not being studied as we speak. On the shelf of every Beis Medrash in the world, okay, is a section called Musar or some topic like that. And prominent on that shelf are the works of Rav Moshe Chaim Luzzatto. So, how do we account for that? How did that happen? Saying, if I stop the shiur right now and somebody stopped you on the street and said, what do you think of that guy, Ramchal? You'd say, he was reviled. He was banned. His books were put in cherem. We can't vouch for him. And yet, right, we have this other reality. It didn't take until 2023. I'll just share with you two quotes. Okay, one of them I have for you on your source sheet, and the other one I didn't put on. One quote I have for you from Elisheva Karlbach, who's one of my teachers, and she just wrote sort of in passing that the Ramchal was posthumously hailed as the father of modern Hebrew literature, a precursor of Hasidim, an explicator of Lurianic Kabbalah, and a pillar of the ethical Musar movement. I have for you in source number 11 the words of Chaim Nachman Bialik, right, who wrote, Hu Asher Bana, this is the Ramchal, Hu Asher Bana Av, Bone Av, L'shloshet Bate HaMedrash HaGdolim Shel Hagra Shel Abal Shem Tov V'Shel Ben Menachem, Moshe Mendelssohn. B'admat Mita'ot Munim Shoreshei Hitpatchut Shel Sifroteinu L'kol Roshei Netzivoteh. Ramchal was the founder of the three great Bate Medrash of the Vilna Gaon, the Baal Shem Tov, and Moses Mendelssohn. In the soil of his planting lie the roots of the development of all our literature. And it's not even a wide enough list. The Ramchal was seized upon by the Hasidim, the Misnagdim, the Maskilim, the Zionists, the Kabbalists, the Musar movement, and the Hebrew literati. They all looked to Ramchal as the ancestor and the precursor of their movement. How do you make it jump? How do you reconcile this tension? Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato reviled, banned, excommunicated in his lifetime, and posthumously, he became one of the most important rabbinic authors, I think I could say, in the history of the Jewish people. How do we reconcile? So this is a hard question, and I really don't purport to have a definitive answer. But I'll share with you, and maybe at the end we can open it up for some conversation, because I'd love to discuss it further and hear your thoughts, because I think it's so provocative. I'll share just in the last 4 minutes three brief observations. First, it's important to remember that there was never total suppression of Ramchal. It's true that Moshe Chagiz was actually Sephardic, but almost all of the opposition that was generated to Ramchal during his lifetime came from the Italians and the Ashkenazim. In Amsterdam, Ramchal was warmly received, and this is important. The folks in Amsterdam held the keys to the printing press. The fact that they began printing his books and approbating his books and providing haskamos to his books and saying, you know, this rabbi said his book is fine, it's a good book, you should read his book, right? That created license for future publication. Okay, that's point one. Point two, sometimes bans are actually counterproductive. Okay, it's like the fifth grade teacher says, this is your new book. Whatever you do, don't read pages 27 and 28. It's not appropriate. Okay. The first page anybody's going to turn to, right, is going to be pages 27, 28. Okay. So sometimes the ban can create a kind of scarcity effect and a curiosity that can actually make the target even more popular. Okay, that's not the answer, but it's something to think about in this context. And I want to conclude with one final point. And that is, I have for you, in the interest of time, I can't get into all of the details. But if you look at source number 12, when you have a minute, you'll see this is a ban. And again, there's dozens of these. This is a ban from Berlin. Some of these bans have a time frame. Okay? It's not that Ramchal is banned for life. It's that Ramchal is banned for, you know, this one says 25 years or 70 years. And I think it's actually very I think it's actually very, very telling. What I mean to say by this point is that the fear, and Rav Yaakov Poppers actually says this, the fear is that, you know, he says, I've been down this road before. Okay, this is not my first rodeo. Kabbalah is a dangerous business. There are these charismatic figures who build ideologies around it, and it's a threat. It's a threat to the community. And he says, I gave you the one example for 1725. That wasn't the only example. Okay, so we've seen this, and you have to get ahead of it, and you have to nip it in the bud, and it's a slippery slope, and otherwise it's going to be very dangerous. So it's not impossible to draw the following conclusion. The bans leveled against Ramchal were self-limiting. They were contingent. To the extent that his writings or his teachings led to heresy or antinomianism, they had to be buried and burned and locked up. But if over the course of time they had no such effect on the Jewish community, the bans could be softened or even allowed to expire. Now, none of this is to say that Ramchal was guiltless. He surely could have played his hand differently and avoided much of the controversy that befell him. In his lifetime, there were a lot of people that judged him, but history is really the ultimate judge. And he now occupies a place in the first rank of Jewish scholars and ethicists. As I said, his work is studied in every Beit Midrash because he was banned out of a fear. And there was like this footnote in the ban, so to speak, that said, we're worried that X, Y, and Z may happen. But if X, Y, and Z doesn't happen, well, then we'll stop worrying. Okay. So functionally, history proved that he wasn't a Sabbatian. He wasn't a heretic. And his works were not going to create a heretical movement. So there was no reason to continue banning them. Now, the first people who read the books may have been in violation, but they ultimately led to this conclusion. In the end, you know, those who read Ramchal's books and celebrated them after his lifetime were actually doing what Ramchal had suggested in another context, which is, you know, as he said in the case of Acher, you know, what does it mean to be wise? What it means is to be able to consume the contents of something important and discard the chaff. And if you're able to do that, so then right, nothing has to be out of bounds. So the Ramchal, as I mentioned, right, today has a sterling reputation. No one knows this story. No one knows any of the controversy that I'm exaggerating a little, but I'm saying you'd have to have taken this class or read one of these treatises to know just how much controversy and enmity that he engendered over the course of his lifetime. But now it's an old story, and no one reading his books today would ever think twice that this Mesilas Yesharim was written by a man who was once considered to be a heretic by the most important rabbis of his generation. I'm going to stop here. I'll remind you that next week, please God, we'll pick up with the Pnei Yeshua and his role in the Emden Eibishitz controversy. And after a 30-second pause, I'll be back to take questions and comments.